Nova may be a 2 seed at this year's NCAA tournament, but that's not all the school has to celebrate. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A Villanova University astronomy professor is participating in a NASA mission this week to get a closer look at red giant stars. Mike and Scott reports from WHYY's Health and Science Desk.
Edward Guinan has looked at many stars through many telescopes, but stepping onto a remodeled 747 as part of NASA's SOFIA mission promises new insights he's excited about.
I never thought I would be flying on a mission like this.
The plane can fly at 50,000 feet, about 5,000 feet higher than a passenger plane, and it has a huge telescope on board.
It flies above most of the atmosphere. Basically, it flies above the water vapor, so that you have a clear view, a clear shot at your targets, at your stars.
Guinan studies red giant stars. They are dying stars in the last stages of their evolution. He's interested in how much mass they are losing and how the dispersing particles are affecting the solar system. I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
The Pennsylvania Department of Health says it's cracking down on lax nursing home inspections. WHYY's Ryan Briggs reports.
An investigation last year found the Department of Health had routinely dismissed or downgraded nearly all the reports of abuse and neglect it received about Pennsylvania's nursing homes. Residents' deaths or injuries were often classified by state inspectors as minor incidents. Dr. Karen Murphy, Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health, says that her department is now ramping up its enforcement efforts in response.
We are taking very seriously our responsibility to protect nursing home residents. We consider it to be the mission of the department.
Murphy says fines issued by inspectors are up 200% compared to last year, and the department has resumed accepting anonymous complaints. A state task force is currently examining further reforms for a report due out this summer.
We have seen the new statistics from the Department of Health, and we are heartened by it.
That's Sam Brooks, a lawyer for the nonprofit Community Legal Services. Brooks helped write the report that exposed Pennsylvania's failure to adequately inspect its nursing homes. While he praises the state's recent efforts, he says real change would mean more than just steeper fines. Brooks says state inspectors need retraining to better detect signs of neglect.
You know, penalties are increasing, but we're concerned that on-the-ground staff are missing serious violations.
Brooks says nursing home residents should also have more of a say in the state's ongoing reform efforts. For WHYY News, I'm Ryan Briggs.
Republican leaders in Washington fear it will become more difficult to win congressional races in Pennsylvania and New Jersey if Donald Trump secures the GOP nomination. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports that most Republicans at the Capitol are not trying to put any distance between themselves and their party's bombastic frontrunner.
There's been a strange quietness, even uneasiness, at the Capitol these days. It crops up when you ask many Republicans about the prospect of having Donald Trump as the Republican presidential nominee.
I'm not going to comment on that.
I'm focusing on my race at this point.
The primary election's coming up, and the people have to decide.
That's New Jersey's Frank Lobiondo and Pat Meehan and Mike Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. Fitzpatrick hasn't endorsed any presidential candidate and says it's not his place to weigh in on the contest.
You know, I think it's important that members of Congress as well not get in front of their constituents and that they listen to their constituents. And this is a democracy, so democracy requires that the people will vote, and that's how their voice heard, and that's all important, and I think democracy's working.
Plenty of his colleagues are taking sides. Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey is in a tough re-election battle and is backing Marco Rubio, the pick of establishment Republicans. We caught up with him as he was quickly trying to leave the Capitol.
Do you worry at all about being on the same ticket as Trump?
We're not there yet. I'm behind Marco.
Toomey's not the only one trying to duck reporters these days. A slate of vulnerable Republican incumbents are now using their staffers to block reporters from even asking them about sharing the ticket with Trump, while others are just flat out saying no comment when asked about their party's leading nominee. Kyle Condick is a campaign analyst with the University of Virginia Center for Politics. He predicts Toomey likely can't win with Trump on the ticket.
If
the Democratic nominee wins Pennsylvania by about what Obama won it by, which was, I think, 5 points, that would be pretty hard for Toomey to overcome. And, you know, if Trump would lose Pennsylvania by more than that, or Cruz, then I think that puts Toomey in some pretty serious jeopardy.
Trump has only received endorsements from 5 members of Congress. One of them is Tom Marino, a Republican from northeastern Pennsylvania. He says his late pick of Trump became easy.
He's saying exactly what my constituents are thinking. And people are fed up with these policymakers.
When asked about Trump's xenophobic, vulgar, and sexist comments, Marino tried to distance himself from most of the headline-grabbing comments his candidate has made.
I don't agree with him on everything. But the thing that I do agree with him on, he's a businessman. He's built a successful business. He's created thousands upon thousands of jobs. He signs the front of paychecks. He's not politically correct.
Lehigh Valley Republican Charlie Dent says GOP voters have been given a bad choice.
You know, you have one candidate for president who is ideologically very rigid, that's Ted Cruz, and one who is ideologically malleable, scattered, and seemingly unmoored, that's Donald Trump. And I've often felt that the more rigid ideologue presents more significant down-ballot challenges than does the more ideologically malleable candidate.
Dent is backing Ohio Governor John Kasich. He says Republicans still have time to figure out a strategy to maintain majorities in Congress if Trump wins the nomination.
I haven't thoroughly analyzed it, but I do have concerns. And like I said, as of now, he's not the nominee. And should he become the nominee, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Freeman's, America's oldest auction house on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, has been bought by a consortium of current managers and partners. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the business has been owned by the Freeman family for more than 200 years.
The boardroom in the Freeman's building on Chestnut Street is lined with 11 portraits of Freeman men representing the 6 generations that have run this auction house since 1805. The current living patriarch is 79-year-old Samuel Freeman II, or Beau, and he points to the paintings while explaining that the business used to be divided between inside things and outside things.
We sold real estate. My grandfather, that guy, and this guy, Uncle Albert, was in charge of the inside.
During its 200-year history, Freeman's has sold 4 U.S. Navy battleships and the entire city of Nitro, West Virginia, lock, stock, and barrel. But for most of the 20th century, Freeman's has focused on art, antiques, and furniture. Its vice chairman, Alistair Nickel, is a regular appraiser on the PBS television show Antiques Roadshow.
There is a way that can help us to identify whether, in fact, it is by the artist. Do you know what that is?
No, I don't.
Nickel is now the co-owner of Freeman's. He and a handful of partners have bought the business from the last Freeman owner.
Frankly, we're sitting here in the boardroom, and every time I come in here and I have 11 sets of eyes, the Freeman family over the centuries looking down at us, we feel the weight of auctioneering history on our shoulders.
Nickel has been managing Freeman's for 16 years now, in that time selling fewer lots for more money. The house used to sell about 50,000 lots a year, but now can make just as much or more, selling only a few thousand lots. As the new owners of Freeman's push the auction house into the international art market, Samuel Freeman will stay on, as will his son, Samuel III. He says the new owners will keep Freeman's a viable company well into the future.
First, I was sad to see it go, but actually, to me, it's the best of all possible solutions.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News. $25 bidder now, $30, 30, will you give me 30, make it 30, bid it
if I'm a $30, will you give me 30, hooray, $30 bid. Still ahead, how do you know when you've recreated a tomato that doesn't exist anymore?
You grow it up to maturity and you look at its features. There are photographs from the old days of the tomatoes, and then you taste it.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
You want to talk economic anxiety? We can talk economic anxiety.
You know, the big one is, are your finances keeping you up at night? And it's 30% of Americans say that their current financial situation is causing them to lose sleep.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the Marketplace Edison Research Poll, second edition, next time.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
The University of Delaware MBA supports WHYY. The UD part-time MBA offers busy professionals the opportunity to pursue their education and their careers with flexible online and on-campus options and a variety of specializations. Prospective students can drop in anytime during their upcoming information sessions on Wednesday, March 18th and Wednesday, April 6th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Learn more about the University of Delaware MBA, including information on their national ranking from PayScale at udmba.com.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. A couple of weeks ago, we heard from listeners whose curiosity and appetite were piqued by a story we aired about limited seed availability for a new New Jersey tomato. Well, now with temperatures summoning thoughts of the growing season at hand, let's go to the source, the Rutgers, New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station. Joining me is Bob Goodman, the Experiment Station's Executive Director. He's also Executive Dean of the Rutgers School of Environmental and Biological Sciences. Dean Goodman, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure.
Bob, many of us of a certain age have fond memories of a most delicious tomato, the Jersey tomato, and of late it just doesn't seem the same. Tell us about this variety called the Rutgers 250.
So Rutgers 250 is the recreation of a very famous tomato that was bred many years ago by Rutgers plant breeders. It was called Rutgers, and it's a hybrid. It had gone out of production because to continue to produce seed for a hybrid, you have to have a market, you have to have the parents, and you have to basically do the breeding every year, every other year, to maintain fresh seed supply. We found out about 8 years ago that Campbell Soup Company, which was one of the clients for the farmers who grew the Rutgers tomato back in the day, had retained derivatives of the original Rutgers parent seeds. And so my group here decided that they would recreate this tomato that was originally released in 1934 by doing the crosses again.
So not to get bogged down in the genetics, but when you have what you're referring to as the parents, how do you know when you've then created an offspring that is the intended product?
You grow it up to maturity and you look at its features. There are photographs from the old days of the tomatoes, and then you taste it.
Ah, the best part.
Exactly.
Tell us, how does it taste?
It's fabulous. You know, the taste of a tomato is a combination of the experience that comes from the juiciness and the relative balance of liquid and more solid flesh. But mostly it comes from a combination of sweetness and sourness or tartness. And the balance of taste is achieved beautifully to most people's palates in the famous Rutgers tomato.
Is it primarily in the challenge of getting the tomato from crop to market where the problem lies?
No, the problem starts, or not the problem, but the opportunity starts in the genetics and then in the growing conditions. And then absolutely it can be ruined by improper handling, which interestingly enough in the tomato can include what people do with the fruit in their homes. For example, they pretty much deteriorate if you put them in the refrigerator. So we always advise folks, if they've got fresh market tomatoes, that they keep them on the countertop.
The Experiment Station's work is not confined to fruits, and I understand your crop of the month is Jersey asparagus.
That's correct. So what we're doing this year during the RU250 celebration is releasing on our website information about one of our crops that we breed. We have done cranberries already. Blueberries will be coming in the early summer. Strawberries, peaches, basil, and thyme, two herbs that we work with. Dogwood trees and holly trees are trees that we've bred for many years in the ornamental area. Turf grass is a major program of ours. Our turf seed is used to build the turf on golf courses all over the world. Yankee Stadium has Rutgers turf. The National Mall is being reseeded in Rutgers turf. Lambeau Field has Rutgers turf.
Bob Goodman is executive director of the Rutgers, New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station. He's also executive dean of the Rutgers School of Environmental and Biological Sciences.
You like tomato, and I like tomato, potato, patata, tomato, tomato. Oh, let's call the whole thing off.
The man whose name is synonymous with genius. Albert Einstein was born on this date in 1879. Let's consider that time and this space with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, Einstein upended long-held notions about space, time, and his theory about ripples in the fabric of space-time was just confirmed through observation last month.
What an amazing career it must have been for him to develop all of the theories that he came up with, his ideas about how the universe is formed and operated, the integrated nature of everything, but yet not be able to get everything confirmed until 100 years later.
Now, for perspective, let's note that until his day, it was still Newtonian physics that ruled for centuries.
And his work totally changed that, completely reversed everything. He had this whole notion of what we now refer to as space-time, where the fabric of the universe, if you will, is affected by the masses as they sort of sit, is not really the word to use, but as they are part of the fabric of space-time.
Now, did he come to this understanding through the use of a telescope, microscope, or primarily chalk on a blackboard?
He was the person who certainly knew the physics. I suppose you would say that he was the ultimate questioner. And because of those questions, he began to formulate these ideas about how the universe must be structured in order for it to really be able to do what we see it doing without violating laws and principles of physics. When we think about this general theory of relativity, that requires an entirely different frame of reference, how gravity and mass related to each other in a manner that was completely different from Newtonian physics, which certainly ruled things before that.
Let's revisit the eloquence of the simplicity of the formula E equals mc squared. What do those letters stand for again?
Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. Very simple, right? But that simple formula means so much more. You know, any mass accelerating toward the speed of light has to convert all of its matter to energy in order to attain the speed of light. So it becomes nearly impossible to attain the speed of light. And then how do other things appear, manifest, or time pass if you're that measure of time itself, because you're now this particle that is traveling at the speed of light? What does the rest of the universe look like to you?
Einstein left this mortal coil in 1955. Was he active to the end of his days?
He was active to the end of his days. What he was working toward was trying to come up with a unified theory of how all of the forces of the universe originally work together. The essence of the unification notion is that all of the forces that we see, strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, electromagnetic force, at one time were all one force. But from that springs all of the rest of what we see.
Einstein is not the only notable with a birthday today in the field.
Yeah, that's true. Apollo astronaut Gene Cernan, who walked on the moon in Apollo 17. He was actually the last man on the moon in 1972. Today is Gene Cernan's birthday also. He was on the moon with Jack Schmidt. In fact, Jack Schmidt was the only geologist, the only real scientist to ever get to the moon. And it's a good thing he got to the moon on Apollo 17 because the Apollo program closed down right after that. And so no others have been to the moon. You can sort of split it out in an interesting way that Gene Cernan was the 11th guy on the moon while Jack Schmidt was the last person to step onto the moon. But the way they came back into the spacecraft is that Jack Schmidt got into the lunar module first and Gene Cernan got in last, making him the last man on the moon.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up without a space.
Finally this evening, if your morning got off to a sleepy start, you weren't alone, as people nationwide struggled today to adjust to daylight saving time. Yesterday, we sprang forward, losing 1 hour of sleep. But on the bright side, gaining an hour of evening daylight. The idea of daylight saving time is often attributed to Philadelphia's favorite son, Benjamin Franklin. But as the History Channel reports, The founding father was only interested in sleeping in during the winter months, not changing the time itself. The misheld belief comes from a satirical letter Franklin wrote claiming that large amounts of money could be saved by simply waking up at dawn and using sunshine instead of candles. For the implementation of the practice, we have Germany to thank, which first pushed its clocks forward during World War I. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tonight, we say goodbye to our intern, Jared Whalen. Jared, thanks for all your hard work. Tomorrow evening, we'll continue our series of interviews with Pennsylvania's Democratic Senate candidates with former Congressman and Navy Admiral Joe Sestak. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Fox School of Business supports WHYY and offers an executive MBA program that is designed to expand the minds and net worth of senior-level professionals. In one weekend per month for 16 months, the Fox Executive MBA enables professionals to take their career to the next level without taking time out of their work week. With career coaching and leadership development, the Executive MBA can help students be competitive in the business world. More at fox.temple.edu/EMBA.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and the eloquence of Mozart. The orchestra's Jeffrey Kaner plays Mozart's first flute concerto, and Ton Koopman conducts Haydn's Symphony No. 83 and Bach's Third Suite. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999 this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center. Bach, Haydn, and Mozart with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Penn Museum supports WHYY. What was behind the legendary story of King Midas and his golden touch? That's a question to be answered not with chests of gold, but with a collection of ancient artifacts from the Republic of Turkey in the world-exclusive exhibition, The Golden Age of King Midas, now open at the Penn Museum. Uncover the true story of this very real and powerful ruler through artwork, jewelry, interactive displays, and more. Details at penn.museum.